Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
I always get into complicated arguments with myself about where one should draw the line on personal responsibility and unreasonable temptation being presented to a person. Take gambling, for example. There are jurisdictions on this planet that consider gambling itself to be an immoral activity because over the long term, the universal truth is the house always wins. It is possible for any person engaging in gambling to temporarily find themselves ahead. Those that are, say, lotto winners who win millions and millions of dollars, they too are temporarily ahead. But if they were to live for, I don't know, hundreds of years and continue buying those tickets, eventually their winnings would be depleted and there would be a net loss over the long term to the house. You've heard the term, the house always wins. It's absolutely true. The only way to win is to get ahead and then quit. The problem is that nobody actually wants to quit while they're ahead because they think they can get even more. So what happens when you're in a situation like that, that some already believe puts unreasonable temptation on a person, exploits them in effect because they do not fully appreciate the long-term ramifications of their actions, and you serve them alcohol, get them drunk? What happens to their ability to make those rational judgments in that situation that already was sort of on the edge in terms of fairness? Well, turns out new research showing that gamblers under the influence of alcohol, and I guess they've known this forever in Vegas, it's why the drinks are free, will place higher bets, not after they win, but after they lose. It's almost a backwards effect. I am fascinated by this research. I have invited the professor in the Department of Psychology and director of the Center for Gambling Research at UBC. He's also the senior author of this study, Professor Luke Clark, joining us. Professor, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Adam. Thanks for having me on the program.
I have always been fascinated. I still remember it was a first-year psychology class, and the professor told us the answer to the question. I actually laughed because I thought it was ridiculous. And the question was a simple one. It's, what sort of reward schedule is most likely to ingrain a behavior in a person? Is it I press the button, I get a reward every time? Is it I press the button, I never get a reward? Or is it when I press the button, I get a random reward? Sometimes I'll win, sometimes I'll lose. And I thought, well, that has to be frustrating. Nobody's going to want to do that. The answer, of course, was the random reward schedule triggers something in our brains that makes us unable to stop. Why is that?
Well, this is true. This is research on that's the variable ratio schedule that you're talking
about.
There. Unpredictable wins are very attractive to people, and the dopamine system in the brain is very interested in winning, but is also interested in trying to figure out patterns.
Yes.
So it would make sense that our reward system and our learning systems would be very interested in that kind of chance situation.
Interesting. So actually, I can see that in terms of an evolutionary benefit. We're trying to figure out the pattern so that we have a model with predictive power so we can figure out how it's going to happen. Problem, though, is that in our gambling games that we construct, there is no easy pattern that one can discern. In fact, if it's random, truly random, there is no pattern at all. So the brain will keep looking for what is not there. Why doesn't it realize that?
Well, in these games of chance, we can see a lot of biases in healthy people and in gamblers and in student participants in our studies, where you're right that they kind of link these events together, even though they're technically independent.
Yeah.
So one of the effects that we look at in our roulette task that we've used in the new research
mm-hmm.
is looking at the gambler's fallacy. This is an effect where if the wheel lands on, say, red 3 or 4 times successively, a gambler might have this kind of strong hunch that the other one must be owed or must be due. So you'd expect a black after a run of red, say.
Yes. I've always found that fascinating, and I still remember introductory statistics courses where the professor is trying to teach the students that, no, the probability of all past events is 100 because they happened. It's only the probability of future events that is uncertain. And I always see people furrowing their brows trying to figure that out. Because you're right, you know, if you say you flip a coin, you get like 6 heads in a row, you're thinking, all right, the odds of us getting tails are really good now, I'm going to put some money on this. Not the case. The way the math works is that it's exactly the same odds of getting tails then as any other flip.
It's true, but it's a very compelling effect, particularly when you're in the game and when you're watching the wheel land on these events. Like I also, you know, I teach this to my class as well. But if I'm watching the wheel and I see, you know, four successive spins, you just get this hunch that you have to, you know, turn off to kind of appreciate the randomness and the independence of this game.
So how does the experiment work in terms of measuring irrational biases? And once we establish that, talk about how alcohol was introduced, because human beings don't need alcohol to be irrational in terms of our expectations. I imagine it certainly doesn't help, though.
Yeah, so this is a roulette task that we've used in a number of experiments to look at, we call these things sequential biases, basically seeing patterns in random data.
Yes.
You're going to play a number of spins on this game, about 100 spins in total, and on each spin, the person simply guesses red or black, and then they're also betting a small amount of money, just a few cents on each of those spins, and they choose the size of the bet that they want to place. And then, as you say, in this study, we've now combined that with an alcohol procedure where our participants get randomized to two groups. One group get an alcohol condition, which is it was a vodka drink mixed with tonic water and bitters. Mm-hmm. And then we have a placebo group who just get the tonic water and bitters without the alcohol. And 20 minutes later, they go into the roulette task.
Is it done on computer? Is there a wheel? How does it work?
No, this is all a computerized game so that we can control and measure exactly what's happening and the responses that they make.
I am curious about how you control for the placebo group being able to taste the difference between an actual vodka and tonic and the placebo version.
Well, that's exactly why we use the tonic water and bitters procedure, and this is in the research on alcohol, this is a very standard procedure. It has quite a strong taste, tonic water, and particularly the bitters actually has a tiny amount of alcohol in it itself, and that means that in that placebo group, they actually, a lot of those participants think that they've received alcohol, and in a way, that's the best placebo condition. The only difference between the two groups is whether they got the alcohol load or not, but both groups have that expectancy.
All right. So what happened when the alcohol was administered after that 20 minutes? What sort of behavioral change was observed?
So the clearest effect of alcohol in our study was that the participants in the alcohol group placed higher bets after losses compared to after wins, whereas the people in the placebo condition didn't show any difference immediately after wins or losses. And we thought that that indicated loss chasing under the influence of alcohol.
What is loss chasing?
So loss chasing is a key feature of problematic gambling. It's when a gambler either continues gambling or sometimes they go back again the next day trying to recover those debts. And you mentioned house edge earlier.
Yes.
Because of the house edge in gambling games, what happens is that by chasing, the debts usually only get worse. So we think of this as quite a desperate behavior, and it's one of the hallmarks, really, of somebody losing control over their gambling behavior.
Is loss chasing a sequential bias wherein we experience the loss so we think the odds of a win get higher simply because of that?
That's one idea, and I think there are a few different ideas about why loss chasing happens, whether their actual perception of the odds are changing or whether this is just a kind of desperate behavior, almost a kind of impulsive behavior without any particular regard to the consequences. But what we're seeing in our study is that alcohol seems to bring out that tendency.
Does it amplify it, or does it create a tendency that otherwise doesn't exist?
In our study, it brought out a difference that was not there in the placebo group. So that was what we were saying, what we were seeing in our study. Yes.
Fascinating. I want to take a quick break. Our guest is Professor Luke Clark. we all understand that they give out free drinks in Vegas, not out of the goodness of their hearts. And I guess not everywhere gives out free drinks. But it's because casino owners figured out a long time ago how to do the math and how to figure out how to wring every last penny out of their customers in terms of choosing to continue gambling. Nobody holds a gun to your head and forces you to place that bet. Nobody holds a gun to your head and forces you to pull the crank on that slot machine. Yet, we do see some people, for whatever reason, are unable to stop with this behavior. Alcohol intoxication may play a role. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with our guest in just a moment. Stay with us.
You're listening to Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Little bit of Viva Las Vegas. Elvis Presley, everybody loves having a little bit of fun from time to time. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. That's the old term. Well, gambling happens all over the place. We have it here in British Columbia, heavily regulated, I might add. But I'm always fascinated by the moral question of where we draw the line between people freely engaging in this activity and to the point where it becomes so torqued against them that it becomes a form of exploitation. Professor Luke Clark, author of this new study showing that problem gamblers, while under the influence of alcohol, are more likely to engage in what they call loss chasing, which is when someone loses, they actually bet even bigger trying to get it back, and then they lose that money as well. Professor, what should policymakers take from the findings of your study in terms of policy change?
Yes, so our study is a laboratory study, and it's looking at a specific effect in this roulette task. But in terms of gambling regulation, I think our findings strengthen the case for paying careful attention to alcohol availability in gambling venues and monitoring alcohol consumption in people who are gambling. And as you say, in BC, we do have some restrictions around that currently. But one of the things that I think is a little neglected here is around the rise of online gambling rise of smartphone gambling, where I think it's very important that the public should also be aware of the risks of alcohol use when gambling at home.
Absolutely. And there's precious little a government can do to prevent a person from being intoxicated when they choose to use their mobile device or their desktop computer to engage in gambling, isn't there?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Like, that's partly a matter of education, but as you say, it's very difficult to monitor that state.
Professor, you're a busy guy. We got to let you go, but I want to say thank you very much for offering us the benefit of your insight and the findings of your study. Any final thoughts?
No, that's been a really interesting discussion, and we're keen to do more research in this area on these links between gambling and alcohol. But thanks for having me on.
All the best. Thank you for your time, sir.
Great. Thanks, Adam.
Take care. Bye now. Professor Luke Clark is a professor in the Department of Psychology and a director of the Center for Gambling Research at the University of British Columbia, also the senior author of this study. Isn't that fascinating? And I still remember, you know, years ago, and you heard the professor explain it better than I did, but for some reason, our brains are wired in such a way is that if you give us a task, like let's say every time you walk up the hill, you get a treat, you get a reward, something like that, it turns out that the way to get the person to do the task as many times as possible is not to guarantee a reward every time, because they'll go up when they want a treat, they'll get the treat, and then they'll stop. If you make it random, if you make it so that sometimes when you do the task, you get nothing, and every so often you get that prize when you do the same task, that scenario is the scenario that will enthrall and encapture a person, in fact, even some animals as well, to do the task over and over and over and over again. In fact, getting more treats, more rewards than you would if the person just got one every time they did it. There's something about that unpredictability of a reward schedule that overrides all sorts of circuitry in our brains and we find absolutely intoxicating and enthralling. Do it while we're drunk or we have alcohol in our system? Well, it's a quick way to empty one's bank account, as you heard our guest describe. We are going to be doing some open lines during the noon show today. There is currently a rally that is underway that we talked with the organizer of, or an organizer of, earlier in the program. It has to do with the QP, Local 441, and School District 63 strike. Yes, I was critical of the government earlier for its hesitation to get involved and bring this matter to a satisfactory and fair conclusion. I still hope that someone does something instead of simply letting all parties involved languish in what appears to be profoundly unproductive time. It's been 7 days since Dave Eberwin of District 63 told us in no uncertain terms.
I want to be crystal clear. There is no more money under the mandate. We have tapped every source under the mandate and put it all towards wages right now.
That was 1 week ago today he said that. The two sides still on strike as we speak. We did have a chance to check in with Mr. Eberwin once again from District 63 earlier today. Let's listen to how some of that conversation went this morning with Al Farabee.
Good morning, Al. Well, you know, we are, as you pointed out, we're into the beginning of the third week of this labor disruption in Saanich schools, and clearly frustrating for everybody involved, including myself. This is not what we want to be doing. I am confident that nobody is preferring to be out on the picket lines, that they'd rather be inside their classrooms and inside their buildings, and I certainly have heard from parents and students and even general community members that everybody would like to see an end to this job action.
Now, you sent out a letter to parents yesterday. Tell me why, and then tell me what's in it.
Well, some of the concerns that or questions that I've been asked through email and through having conversations with parents is, what does this mean for my child's education moving forward? And so felt it was important to get a general letter out to everybody, but in particular for those students who are in grade 12 and have questions around, what does this mean for my graduation or my goal of going to post-secondary school? And so we wanted to get some fairly clear information out there to parents about the impact of this on their child's education.
Can you walk through some of the things that you mentioned in the letter?
So, you know, we have had school closures before for a variety of reasons, things like snow closures. Last year, we closed schools for 3 days. Sometimes there's a power outage for a couple of days and we can't get the power back up. We've also had previous education strikes. There was a strike back in 2014 province-wide that shut schools down from the middle of June until almost the end of September. And so when we have these disruptions, we look at doing a variety of things, such as changing end-of-term dates, moving the end of the semester out a little bit later, rescheduling things like parent-teacher interviews, modifying what report cards will look like to get information out into the hands of parents sooner rather than later, and certainly instructional strategies where teachers might have done a week-long group project on something. They might do a day's worth of direct instruction to get the same content through to students. So there's all sorts of different accommodations around instruction, assessment, and timing that we can do so that our students are not disadvantaged as they move through the year.
I see other things, too. Like, I mean, obviously, you are feeling the anxiousness and nervousness of students and parents in what this is. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Yeah, there is a lot of anxiety out there. And my goal is not to minimize the disruption. Certainly this has been very disruptive to students and parents, but I think it's also important not to hyperbolize the disruption as well, too. This is extremely inconvenient. There is time lost from the classroom, and those are both facts. But this is not a situation that we are unable to recover from. In fact, I believe that we'll be able to provide an excellent education to students, and we'll be able to prioritize things in a way so that students aren't disadvantaged as compared to their peers. Again, I'm not trying to minimize the disruption. It is extremely unfortunate. It is inconvenient. It is disruptive, but it is not disastrous. We will be able to recover from this, and we will be able to give the students education that they deserve and need.
As far as I know, everything he is saying is correct and accurate, as long as the disruption ends relatively soon. My concern, and I will reiterate it as many times as is necessary, is that there are currently dark clouds on the horizon for labor disruption affecting not only District 63 Saanich, but all school districts across this province, with the BCTF saying they are watching this very closely. In fact, I can't help but think that the poor folks in Saanich find themselves the victim of a proxy war between two much greater powers that are testing the waters for a potential province-wide disruption. What happens if we go 3 weeks, 4 weeks, we finally get the Saanich situation settled, and then boom, the entire province goes out? and the folks already on their last legs financially from weathering the Saanich disruption suddenly find themselves again outside on the picket line or again unable to send their kids to school, what are they supposed to do? Like, how are they supposed to get through this? I don't know. It's going to be tough. Anyway, let's listen to the rest of it.
Yet, I sense, and you know the timelines better than I, that we are venturing in or we are in some uncharted territory in what this is.
Well, if we go back to the education strike in 2014, classes were out for many more weeks than what we are right now, and that was system-wide across the province. And there is an adjustment to the end of semester one, and at that time we had provincial exams, and those were adjusted, and students got through their courses, obtained their credits, went to university and college, and people don't even talk about that strike anymore as being disruptive or life-altering. And this is a very unfortunate situation that we're in, and one that I and all of us in the district are working at great lengths to try and bring to a closure.
I think everybody needs to do their utmost to bring this to a closure, certainly not for reasons limited to the fact that the BCTF 2014, was it a lockout or was it a strike? I can never remember. Let's just call it a strike for the sake of argument. Yeah, it's true. People did recover from that, but that also might happen in this case. It is not either or. It's possible that this labor disruption will drag on for weeks and then the double whammy hits as we go directly from that into the full-scale strike action at all schools in the Victoria area. Then who does everybody rely on? I don't have an answer to that. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll get the latest from the newsroom. We'll do Victoria Noon. Then I want to do some open lines for the noon show. 250-386-1161 *1070. A free call on your wireless device. You can weigh in on the strike. You can weigh in on anything that we've discussed on the program so far this week. I also hear the Extinction Rebellion's doing another, a protest today? Outside the Times Call, you know, let me tell you something, folks. Times Calling says great work in terms of journalism. Nobody's paying me to say that. I'm not obligated to say that. I'm recognizing good work being done in this community, regardless of where it comes from. Times Calling works a lot more credible than anybody demanding net carbon zero by 2025. That's nonsense. Anyway, it's just my 2 cents. Quick break. News is next.